Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour. And during this hour you can call in if you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith and we'll talk about them here. If you have a different viewpoint from the host, which is almost certainly true of many people, most people probably have something they differ with me about, you're always welcome to call and we can unpack it and we can discuss that further. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. And our lines are full. So let's talk to Dwight from Denver, Colorado. Dwight, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Psalm 119 has nothing but high praises for God's law, and yet Peter said that the law was a yoke that neither we nor our fathers could bear, and Paul said it was a ministry of death and a ministry of condemnation. And I just wonder about that contradiction. And one further question is, Psalm 19:7 says the law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. How could the law of the Lord convert the soul?
Well, the word convert means to change. So your soul can certainly be changed by your contemplation of and submission to the law of God. It's true throughout the Bible, even in the New Testament, the law is said to be a good thing. And David, or whoever wrote Psalm 119, was enamored with it and found it extremely edifying and wisdom providing and so forth for him to meditate on it day and night, as he says in Psalm 119, and there are other places too. In Psalm 19, he says that the law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul, as you mentioned, but he also said that it's all kinds of good things, and it says it's sweeter to the mouth than honey and more to be desired than gold. So, I mean, you'll find a lot of this in the Psalms, that the law is a great, wonderful thing, and it is. In fact, God told Israel through Moses that they were particularly privileged to have a God so near that he would give them instructions about how to live in all these important ways. In fact, Moses said, you don't depart from this law because it is your boast before the nations who will be amazed at the wisdom of the law that that God has given you. It's your boast. Now, so the Jews had every reason to boast of them. Now, when Peter said that it was a yoke that no one could bear, and Paul spoke of it as a bondage too, what I think he's saying, what they're saying is this, that it's not that the contents of the law are particularly burdensome. In fact, in Deuteronomy, God said it's not difficult for you. You don't have to ascend into heaven to bring it down or anything. It's what I've commanded you is not difficult for you to do. It's near you. It's even in your mouth and in your heart. So there's nothing that the New Testament would say that would suggest that the laws themselves that God gave are a burden. What was a burden is the whole system of relating to God under a legal code that had the kinds of penalties associated with it that it did. Because even though we may love the law, we may find ourselves not able to fully keep it. And if we don't fully keep it, then there's penalties for that, and that's a tremendous burden. You know, Paul talks about that famously in Romans chapter 7. He says in verse 22, "For I delight in the law of God according to the inward man, but I see another law in my members warring against the law of my mind and bringing me into captivity to the law of sin and death in my members." What Paul talks about earlier in Romans 7 is that he was alive before he knew the commandments of God. But then the commandments of God came and they condemned things he had done. And so he had to live under a condemnation, a burden of condemnation for his having broken them. But he says the law is great. The law is good. I love the law. He says, I know that the law is spiritual, but I'm fleshly, sold under sin. So, I mean, he says all of that in Romans 7. So the problem is not that God gave laws that aren't good laws. It's just relating to God under a system of law where your acceptance or rejection by God comes from your diligence in keeping the law, and there's severe penalties for not doing so. That's a burdensome thing compared to relating to God as a father through grace, where our sins have been covered by Christ, and we now just relate to God in love. And you know, it says in 1 John chapter 5, this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not burdensome, which is interesting, because that's just the opposite of saying that it's a burden. He said they're not burdensome, but this, he says, that's how we know that we love God. The love of God, he says, is known by the fact that we keep his commandments and don't find them to be burdensome. That's 1 John 5:3. So if you're relating to God strictly on a legal basis, that's troublesome, because laws have penalties and because people are imperfect. And there's this law in our members called sin that brings us into condemnation. It's great to be out from under that. It's a wonderful thing to be out from under that. It doesn't mean that the contents of the law were bad. It's the system of relating to God on the basis of legalism, really, is the problem that was so burdensome for Peter and Paul, apparently.
Great. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. Thank you.
Okay, Dwight, great talking to you. God bless you.
You too.
Bye now. Okay, our next caller is Sarah, calling from Pleasant Hill, California. Sarah, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. My question is from Mark chapter 13 on the Olivet Discourse there.
Yeah.
And I was listening to a teacher who had the futurist view of that passage, and he objected to what the preterists sometimes say about Eusebius confirming that the Christians in that time had fled.
Uh-huh.
Because he said that the city that Eusebius mentioned was not in the mountains.
I've heard them say that, yeah. No, it's hilly. It's hilly. If you look it up online, you'll find that it's a hilly region. It's true. The hills in that region would not be what you and I might call mountains if we happen to live near the Rockies or near, you know, some mountain range, where we in America have some pretty big mountains. Israel doesn't have as many really big mountains, and some of the areas that are hilly, they would call mountains. In fact, the Mount of Olives is called the Mount of Olives, but it's really just a hill, you know. And so to say, well, it's not a mountainous area, well, it depends on what you call mountainous. It's hilly, and in the use of the word mountain in Israel, that suffices.
Oh, okay. Okay, I didn't realize that. That's helpful.
Yeah.
And then really quick, the abomination of desolation. He had also mentioned that some translations say that it's a hit, that it's an it, and others say that it's a he. Do you know anything about that?
There are, I think, manuscript differences there in some of the references.
Okay.
But I don't see how that would change anything. He, if it is he, it would be, you know, the invading army, you know, the commander of the army, and the army's with him. He's coming. Or if it's it, it's simply referring to the invasion. We know that the abomination of desolation is the Roman invasion, because we have Luke telling us so in Luke chapter 21, which is the parallel to Mark 13. It's the same discourse. And as you read through, put Mark 13 and Luke 21 next to each other and read through it, you find at the very point where Jesus says in Mark 13, when you see the abomination of desolation, you'll flee to the mountains. We have Luke saying, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, etc. You know, it's the same prediction, but what has happened is both Matthew and Mark use the strange Hebraism that Jesus used, which is taken from Daniel, which is the abomination of desolation, which literally means an abominable thing that causes desolation. Now, Luke paraphrases that. He's not writing to a Jewish reader. He's writing to a Greek man named Theophilus, and doesn't assume that he would understand, you know, these Hebraic expressions, so he just paraphrases it. It's talking about the same thing where Jesus said abomination of desolation. Luke paraphrases it, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. So the surrounding of Jerusalem by armies is going to bring about its desolation. That is the abomination that brings desolation. It's just that Luke makes it less ambiguous. You see, popular futurist teaching indicates the abomination of desolation is going to be the Antichrist setting an image of himself in a rebuilt temple in Jerusalem. The biggest problem with that is, of course, there's no reference in the Bible to an Antichrist making an image of himself and putting it into a temple. There is a place in 2 Thessalonians that talks about the man of sin sitting in the temple. There's no reference to an image of him there, just he sits in the temple. And in Revelation 13, there is a reference to the second beast makes an image of the first beast, but it's nowhere said to be putting in a temple or even in Israel. There's no geographical information given about it. It's just an image that people are made to worship. There's no suggestion that it's in the temple. So there's actually nothing in the Bible that suggests an image of the Antichrist will ever be put into a rebuilt temple. People come up with these things by putting together little bits of pieces from here and there that none of them say that. And in many cases, they're putting together passages that aren't necessarily talking about the same subject. But they don't know that, apparently. And so they just kind of make this composite drawing based on pieces that aren't even necessarily always talking about the same thing. Anyway, that's the popular view, but it can't be true because Luke gives us the true view. I mean, if we assume Luke is an inspired writer, then we assume that when he paraphrased Abomination of Desolation to mean Jerusalem surrounded by armies, well, then he was correctly paraphrasing it. He's actually bringing out the real meaning of it. He does us a great service for those of us who might otherwise find the expression Abomination of Desolation rather confusing. Luke anticipated that, and he removed the confusion by paraphrasing it.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Sarah, thank you for your call. We're going to talk next to JB from Seattle, Washington. JB, welcome.
Hello, Brother Steve. I wanted to say thank you so much for your ministry. It has really helped me reevaluate my salvation over the past year or so. I have a two-part question for you. I was a pastor's kid since the age of 4 or 5. My parents went to Kenneth Hagin Ministries, which is Rhema Bible School, back in the 80s, and they were very their gospel was preached about Word of Faith, and some of it was pertaining to prosperity teaching. I'm really fearful for what I've learned over the past couple of years that is misguiding a lot of people, and they've hurt a lot of people in the past, and I'm really worried about their salvation. So I wanted, my first question is, do I approach them for someone that maybe may not be approachable and is so strong-headed about this Kenneth Hagin Ministries?
You're talking about your parents now?
Yes.
Yeah, it's awfully hard to change your parents' minds, but it's not impossible. Let me just say this. I never, of course, went to Rhema Bible College or any Bible college, but I did read Kenneth Hagin about a decade earlier than what you're talking about. Your parents were there in the 80s, the early 70s. I read a lot of Kenneth Hagin's works, and that's before I knew better. I mean, I was a teenager. But I had a mind like a sponge, and I absorbed all his arguments and all his proof texts, and all his testimonies were impressive. And so, not knowing the whole of Scripture well enough, I kind of thought those proof texts he used probably were being taken in a valid way. And so I became, briefly, Word of Faith. All it took, however, was to read the whole Bible more carefully, and then I realized that every verse that he used was taken out of context. Now, that mattered to me. Taking Scripture out of context was a serious problem in my sight. Now, I don't know if it's a serious problem in your parents' sight. I mean, you can show that all the proof texts for the Word of Faith teaching are taken out of context. In fact, in their context, they can be seen as mean something somewhat different than the Word of Faith is trying to make them say. But I've met an awful lot of people wrapped up in cults and in false doctrines who really do not want to know that the verses they're using are not being used fairly or correctly. It can be shown to them, but they're so invested that it's very, very difficult for them, maybe even impossible for them, to see their way around it. Now, this is especially true if the person who's correcting them is their own son or daughter. And that's simply because parents, now I don't know your parents, maybe they're incredibly humble people and maybe very teachable. If so, then that's great, and maybe they can change, but a very small percentage of the population are so humble and teachable that when they've been preaching for 45 years a certain doctrine, if their own offspring says, you're understanding that wrong, very few want to be corrected by their children. I'm not saying they aren't. I mean, the Bible does say a little child shall lead them. And, there are Christians who've been brought to faith or to better doctrine through the influence of their offspring, but it's very difficult. I would say, now, have you ever listened to my lectures on the Word of Faith?
Yes, I have, and kind of to answer your question, I noticed that a lot of Word of Faith teachers, they manipulate their sermons mm-hmm. to their benefit to either maybe retain more congregation, and that's kind yeah. of my question to my second question.
Yeah.
Do most of these mega churches, do they know what they're doing, manipulating God's word for the benefit of fame or money?
Well, you know, there's an element in the Christian life that has been underemphasized and seems to be absolutely lacking in some Christians' lives, and that's called the fear of God. The Bible, both Old and New Testament, says that we should live our lives in the fear of God. And when you fear God, it means you want to make sure you do not displease him in the way you handle his word or in the way you mislead people about him. Now there's a lot of ministers who honestly simply don't fear God. I mean, you can tell, because they'll play fast and loose with the scripture, and they won't care if you tell them they're using it wrong. They don't want to hear it. They just want to keep doing it. In some cases, they're making a good living by teaching what they're teaching, and they have a very little motivation to give that up. In other cases, like in the Word of Faith, lots of people are very emotionally attached to it because it tells them they never have to be sick or poor. I mean, carnal people, what more can you ask them that they value more than that? You never have to be sick or poor. I mean, and there's an awful lot of carnal people in the church. Let's face it, there's a lot of unconverted people in the church. Now, you said you're concerned about your parents' salvation. I'm not saying they're unconverted. I mean, they could be like I was in the 70s. I read Kenneth Hagin, pretty impressive stuff. I mean, he has great testimonies about healings and stuff that he's involved in. He's got Bible verses he uses. He's not much of an exegete, but he certainly lays out a lot of verses. And, you know, I mean, they may be very innocently convinced that this is what the Bible teaches. But innocence lasts only so long as nobody has shown you that what you're doing is misusing the Bible. Once you have been shown that you're misusing the Bible, you cannot remain innocent and still misuse the Bible. You know, many people misuse the Bible accidentally, and they would never do so knowingly. But once you've raised the question about their interpretation, you know, if once they see that it's not so, if they still want to teach it because it's still what they want to believe, or you know, or what their congregation wants to believe, then they've given up their innocence and their integrity. Now, I want to say this though: just because you show somebody that the Bible isn't teaching what they think it's teaching, it doesn't mean that you have convinced them. In other words, if I talk to a dispensationalist and he's convinced the Bible teaches dispensationalism, and I show him all the verses that led me away from dispensationalism, and I show how they're taking verses out of context and so forth, they may not change right away, but that doesn't mean they're dishonest. I know it took me a long time to see around the interpretations that I'd been fed, and just because some person, especially some unknown person, you know, says, oh, that's not the right way to understand it, that doesn't mean it would have convinced me that it's not the right way to understand it. The conviction has to grow through personal research, personal meditation, personal study of the Word. And I believe there's a lot of people teaching false doctrine who have a good heart, and they believe that the false doctrine they're teaching is exactly what the Bible teaches and that they're being faithful to God. In fact, they think it would be an insult to God to teach otherwise. You know, Jesus said there will be a time when people put you to death and think they're doing God a favor. So, I mean, people can be really wrong about what God's pleased it with. As far as their salvation is concerned, that's between actually them and God. I don't think you'd be in the position to judge whether their salvation is at risk or not, probably. I mean, I generally do not make those kinds of judgments about other people unless they are so blatantly crazy and dishonest and you know, in it for the money and all that stuff. I mean, if you see people who are like described like the false prophets in 2 Peter chapter 2, they're in it for the money, they're in it for the, you know, fleshly reasons. Well, okay, then I guess I can pretty much judge that their salvation probably is a fiction. But I do believe there's a lot of people who really are saved and who've been taught very badly, and they're quite convinced that they're teaching exactly what Jesus and the apostles taught, and that they are doing so out of faithfulness to God. It's a very sad thing, but perhaps we're all doing that in a few points. You know, maybe we all think everything we teach is what the apostles taught, and we might find out some things we were wrong about. The main thing is, what I would do if I were you, I mean, you could give them a book, or you could have, or you could suggest that they listen to my lectures, which is easier than reading a book. I have those four lectures on the Word of Faith. And say, listen, I've been listening to this guy on the radio. He has these teachings against the Word of Faith. You know, I'm kind of struggling with this. Can you critique these for me? Can you look at the listen to these and critique them for me? That could get a conversation going, and it doesn't look like you're attacking them. It looks like you're seeking their help in better understanding.
I appreciate, brother. You have a great ministry, and I hope God continues to bless you.
Okay, JB, thank you for your call. I appreciate it. God bless you. Bye now. Hey, Andy from Thailand, who has not called much lately, but used to call more often. Welcome to The Narrow Path from Thailand.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is regarding the seven signs in the Gospel of John and the wedding at Cana is connected with the death and resurrection. And I can't figure out why they're connected. And
why do
I was
you say,
wondering if you have...
Why do you say there's that connection? I had never seen such a connection with it. What is it you're seeing there as a connection to his death and resurrection?
Well, there's... so they call them all signs, and you have the wedding at Cana, then you have raising the son from the dead, you have lame man healed at the pool, feeding of the 5,000, which is the center, then you have blind man healed at the pool, raising Lazarus from the dead, and then you have the death and resurrection.
Right. I'm familiar with the seven signs in John. I'm just saying where some of them obviously correspond to something Jesus said, like the multiplication of the loaves clearly connected even in proximity with the miracle, him saying, I'm the bread of life, or when he said, I'm the resurrection of the life in chapter 11. This is just before he raised Lazarus from the dead, or, you know, when he said, there's quite a few of these in there. You know, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. It's not clear exactly what he's connecting that to in terms of any of his miracles. It could be one of the miracles that are mentioned earlier. But, you know, his turning water into wine, I think that what that's illustrating is his statement in John chapter 15, I'm the true vine. That's what vines do, is they turn water into wine. That's why people plant vines. They want wine, and they get it by watering vines, and that water through the organism of the vine eventually turns into grape juice and then wine. So when he said, I'm the true vine, and he turned water into wine, it seems to me that that's what that one corresponds to. So I'm not seeing that as a connection with his death and resurrection.
Well, besides the chiasm, they also have similar, like in the wedding, he says, my hour is not yet come. In the death, he says, Father, my hour is come. In the wedding, and his disciples believed in him. In the death and resurrection, finally, the other disciples saw and believed in him. That he got stabbed and water and blood came out. So it seems like there's, other than the chiasm, there's also some verbiage. Also, in the wedding, it starts off on the third day, which is just some random third day of what? So it seems like there's...
Well, it's not random. It's not random because that's in that's at the beginning of chapter 2, and the last part of chapter 1 kept saying what day it was. In chapter 1, verse 29, it says, the next day John saw Jesus. Then verse 35 again, the next day John stood with two of his disciples. Then in verse 43, the following day, Jesus wanted to go to Galilee. And then chapter 2, verse 1, on the third day, there was a wedding. So it sounds like it's actually numbering days. It's not a random reference to the third day. It's following a chronology. Now, as far as the chiasm, you know, I know a lot of Bible teachers who are very fascinated with chiasms. And some of them are quite impressive. I mean, that is some of the chiasms. A chiasm, for those who don't know what that is an arrangement of material where, let's just say there's seven things, and the first one corresponds with the seventh one. And then the second one corresponds with the sixth one. And the third one corresponds with the fifth one, and then there's the fourth one in the middle. In other words, the arrangement of material, is there some kind of correspondence between the parts on the outer limits of the structure, and then moving toward the middle, there's correspondence toward the one that's one removed from the first with the one that's one removed from the last, and then between the one that's two removed from the first to the one that's two removed from the last. I think chiasms are a fascinating thing, but I don't think all the Bible books are written in the form of chiasms. I know some people really find them everywhere, and I don't know that we really have that going on in John. Maybe, I mean, if you do, then you can see it that way, but I see I am the true vine as being illustrated in Jesus turning water into wine, since that's what vines do. Hey, I need to take a break, but I appreciate your call. It's good to hear from you again. You're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We have another half hour coming up, so we're not really done. We are listener supported. If you'd like to help us pay for the radio bills, then you can. And I've just noticed the last 2 months, the income has gone down the last 2 months. Even we're operating at a bit of a loss those months. However, we are not afraid that we'll be able to keep going. Go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, and you can see how you can help us. I'll be back in 30 seconds.
If truth did exist, would it matter to you? Whom would you consult as an authority on the subject? In a 16-lecture series entitled The Authority of Scriptures, Steve Gregg not only thoroughly presents the case for the Bible's authority, but also explains how this truth is to be applied to a believer's daily walk and outlook. The Authority of Scriptures can be downloaded in MP3 format without charge from our website, thenarrowpath.com.
Welcome back to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for another half hour taking your calls. If you want to call in with a question about the Bible or the Christian faith, or maybe register a disagreement with the host, feel free to do that. The number is 844-484-5737. That number again is 844-484-5737. Our next caller is another Sarah. We had a Sarah in the first half hour, too. Sarah from California, welcome.
Hi. In Titus 2:5, it has a list of qualities that a Christian wife should have or do. And one of them is being a keeper at home. So I was wondering if you thought wives should be full-time homemakers?
Well, in the Greek, it says a worker at home, a home worker. I think insofar as there is work to be done at the home, and especially if that work includes rearing children, it is best for a woman to be there. I don't think it's the best situation for both parents to be out in the workforce and when there's children at home who need discipling day and night. So, I think that Paul saw this as very desirable, that the wife would, she'd manage the home. Actually, in one place, he referred to the wife as the, he used a Greek word that means house despot. Like she's the despot. Like she's the monarch. She's the queen of the house. And Paul saw it that men and women have complementary roles in family life. A few days ago I heard somebody say, you know, a man should do half of the domestic chores because it should be a 50-50 arrangement. I disagree. I mean, I don't think the wife has to go out and do half of the fund provision. There are cases where she does, but I don't know that that's the ideal. We live in a time where sometimes families really can't make ends meet at all unless both parents are working. And frankly, there's families where there's no man in the home at all, and the woman has to do all the working. So obviously, there is an ideal that Paul sees for family norms. And I agree with his ideal. I have no reason to disagree with him. I think he's speaking for God about the ideal. But the ideal also has got to be presented in the framework of we live in a society where things are not always ideal. And to the degree that we can approximate the ideal, we should, because it's ideal. You know. So I do believe that God structured the family so that the man usually is providing and protecting, providing for and protecting the family, and the woman is nurturing the family and, nesting. And so the woman does make a home that's pleasant for the children and the family. The husband actually pays for it. And they're both doing a very, essential thing. Now, in the modern family, again, it's very, very normal for the husband and wife to both go out and work. I don't think this is always necessary, but I could imagine situations where it is. And there are times, no doubt, where the man simply is not, just can't make enough money. But I think probably more often than not, it's just that he doesn't make as much money as they would like to have. And therefore, for the wife to decide if she's going to go out and work is not a decision about whether they will starve or not, or whether they'll have a roof over their head or not, but whether they'll have a certain degree of luxury that they would like to have. Because frankly, even minimum wage is so high now. Just a person who works a minimum wage job, or a man could work two minimum wage jobs or something, work more than 8 hours a day, God forbid. Yeah, but that's what people did throughout history. Could very probably provide a very modest shelter and a modest style, lifestyle. Now, I say that as a person who lived that way for very, very, very many years of my child raising. I raised five children, and I lived in what most people would call the poverty level. And I guess I'd call it that, too. But we never lacked anything we needed. We lacked what many other families had, but we didn't care. Paul said, having food and clothing, with these we'll be content. The thing is, if the man can provide for, a dry home in the rain and food on the table and clothing as necessary and other true necessities with his work, but they'd like to have more, the woman has to decide, the man and the woman, I suppose, together have to decide, are the things they want to add to their standard of living by her working, are those more important than the few years you have to really nurture your children at home? They grow up so fast. Anyone who's got grown kids says that. They grow so fast. They do. It doesn't seem like it when you've got babies and toddlers. It seems like time's going by really slow. But when they're no longer babies and toddlers, you think, I loved them so much at that age, I wish they could have been that way a little longer. Now, not everyone agrees with me. That's certainly how I felt, and that's how my wife felt. I mean, that's how I think ordinary people feel before the whole feminist idea that, there's no difference between men and women, and there's no more reason for a woman to be home with the kids than for the man to be. That's simply a violation of the norms of society throughout history and also the biblical norms. However, norms, can't always be met in some situations. We live in a fallen world, an imperfect world, and that's why, that's why John can say, brethren, I write these things to you so you don't sin, but if anyone does sin, we have an advocate with the Father. Now, he said the norm is that Christians don't ever sin. However, the reality is sometimes we do. And I'm not saying that deviating from the norm in Titus is sinning. I'm just saying that God is realistic. He knows what is best. And if we can have the best and do the best, then I think we should. If we can't, God knows that too. And it's not like you have to live under condemnation for it. But I do think Christians, families where they have children that are still being reared, and the husband and wife both have jobs, I think they would be wise. I'm not making a legalistic thing. I think they'd be very wise to sit down and say, could we live on the income of one of us? Could we trim it way, way down, trim our expenses down so that we can actually have children come home to a mom who's there for them, training them, nurturing them, and to a dad when he comes home? In other words, what some people so despise, modern feminists despise it incredibly, although I think LGBT plus people despise it even more, and that is what we call the traditional family. But it's traditional because every society did it until the 20th century. And the reason they did it is because there were no other models of family that worked better. And in the Christian world, it's because the Christian taught it. The Bible taught it. So those are my thoughts about it. Yeah, Paul does speak about the desirability of the woman being home, loving her children, loving her husband, working at home if possible. The woman, people often mention the virtuous woman in Proverbs 31. They say, well, see, she was a businesswoman. She was. But she worked from home. She made sashes, and then she sold them to the merchants. Not, she didn't go in the marketplace and be a merchant. The merchants came in, and she was a supplier. She had a a cottage industry. And there are many things that people can do from the home that, in fact, some people can even, you know, do some kind of part-time work online these days without even going out of the house. But I wouldn't suggest that a woman do this while her children are awake and need her attention. I mean, you only get one chance with each of these children to give them enough attention, enough training, and a sense of security that comes from having an intact family. And, you know, those who can't give that to their children, I think we should be a little sad about that. You can't feel guilty about that if you can't make it happen. Some people can't. But I think we should not recognize it as an alternative that's just as good as the norm. There are alternatives that are not as good as the norm. They may be tolerable, but they're not as good as what's normal, the ideal.
Thank you so much.
Okay, Sarah, God bless you. Thanks for calling. Good talking to you. All right, let's talk to Rick from Phoenix, Arizona. Rick, good to hear from you again.
Hey, Steve, hi. To Isaiah chapter 50 and 51, this is probably not really a good question because it involves a lot of scripture, but I notice in here you made a really good point in other scriptures that God divorced, or he nullified the covenant because the nation of Israel had broken the covenant, the old covenant that they had with him. And so God said, okay, that's it. I'm not going to honor this covenant anymore. And he had, I think it was Jeremiah, I believe, or one of the prophets that that illustrated that to them. But now I was seeing the other night in chapter 50, he's saying here, where is the certificate of your mother's divorce whom I have put away, and so forth. And then he goes on describing that their marriage with him was annulled because of their failures. Then he moves on to, in the same chapter, things that sound very, very messianic. So my question is, it sounds to me, while I'm reading this, I'm thinking, it sounds to me like in the end, he is sure the law is nullified, or the old covenant is broken and no longer applies. But it sounds like he's going to restore it. And so
he brings
that.
A new covenant. Yeah, the restoration is under new covenant. Now, here's the thing. The old covenant was with those who agreed to be part of it. At Mount Sinai, God offered himself as their God and gave them the option to be his people. And the nation said, we will do it. We'll accept this. So they all agreed to it. When he made the new covenant, they didn't all agree to it. Only the remnant did. See, when Jesus came and offered the new covenant, many of the Jews, most of them actually rejected him, and some of them crucified him. But there was a remnant of Israel that entered that covenant. So, you know, he does restore Israel, but it ends up only being those that will participate in that restoration. And that was the remnant who came to Christ and accepted the new covenant, and we are among them too. So, now I will say this. In Isaiah 50, in verse 1, where it says, where is the certificate of your mother's divorce? I used to not see that correctly. I used to think he's saying there was one. But as I understand the flow of the passage, he's saying he had not yet given her one yet. You know, he has put her away, but he hasn't really given her a certificate of divorce yet. So there's still hope of coming back to him. And so he's encouraging them to not see themselves as yet divorced. But 100 years later, Jeremiah wrote in Jeremiah chapter 3 in verse 8, then I saw that for all the causes for which backsliding Israel had committed adultery, I had put her away and given her a certificate of divorce. So so Jeremiah was writing 100 years later. In the time of Isaiah, God was rebuking his wife Israel, as it were, calling her back to repentance and saying, I have not yet divorced you. You can come back around. But it was 100 years later that he says, I have given you a divorce. I have divorced.
Well, that was exactly where my mind was going. I didn't say it, but I was wondering if later on he finally said, okay, this is enough.
Yeah.
And that's what happened, was 100 years later. I wondered when Jeremiah was doing that, or who, whatever the prophet was yeah. I think he said Jeremiah. Yeah. And so that actually came 100 years later, and God was acting within time and space when he did that. It wasn't like he was just talking about, hey, I'm never going to divorce you. You think you're divorced, but I'm going to restore you. No, he's saying at the time, he's saying, look, I haven't divorced you yet. You know, show me, yeah. you know, come back. And then he goes on and starts describing the sacrifice of Jesus. And
the point is that even before God divorced Israel in Jeremiah 3:8, even in Isaiah's day, of course, he was describing the new covenant was coming too, which yeah. maybe could be said to presuppose the old one was going to be removed.
Right.
You know, since Hebrews said where there's a new covenant, the old one's obsolete. But Isaiah yeah. is saying that has not yet happened to them. They are perhaps doing the very things that will eventually cause him to do it, and they should stop doing them, but he has not yet given her a certificate of divorce in Isaiah 50, verse 1. But
in the rest of Isaiah 50 there, he starts talking about the crucifixion, the sacrifice, and that's going to be the new covenant, and that's where they're going to be restored.
Right, and again, those will be restored who will agree to be restored. And, of course,
right.
The old covenant at Mount Sinai was, they all agreed to be part of that. So the whole nation became
right.
the covenant people. But when Jesus came, the whole nation did not agree to the new covenant. Only the remnant did. And that's what started the actual restoration of Israel is the restoration of the remnant, the new covenant made with them. The rest of
right.
the Jews who rejected the new covenant, of course, that was trashed and obsolete and they became just like any other unbelievers.
Right, right. Well, thank you, Steve. That was a terrific answer. Have a great day.
All right. Well, thanks for your call, Rick. Good talking to you. Let's see here. Daryl from Texas. Welcome to The Narrow Path from Dallas.
Hello, Steve.
Hi.
You've been such a blessing to me, and I've never in the last year I've been listening to you heard you ask for money the way you did a few minutes ago. So I'm going to make the biggest donation I can tonight. Anyway, let me get to my question.
Well, let me clarify that first. Let me clarify that. We have months
sure.
where we have months where more income comes in than we need for that month, and we have months where less income comes in, but it all evens out. So far, it's been a very long time since we've had to drop any stations, but it's not like we never will. It's just that our income was down in January. And it was down further yes. in February. Down further in February. So, I mean, it might go up this month. We have no way of knowing. It goes up and down. But it's if it keeps going down, we're going to have to talk about cutting some stations. But I don't know that. I don't think we're at that point yet. But thank you.
Yeah, we would hate to lose you on 7:70 a.m. here in Dallas, Texas. We would hate to lose you. Way back in 1980, I know this would never happen nowadays, but I actually took a Bible class as an elective in high school, in public
wow.
schools. And, yeah, wow.
Probably the Bible is literature class, yeah.
And I still remember a comment my teacher made, Miss Kitterman. She's probably long past now. But she said at one point, you know, a lot of us kids in there, we were into the heavy metal music and all that. And she said that any music that doesn't glorify God is from Satan. And I've always thought about that ever since. You know, I'm 55 now. I still think about it, and I don't even listen to music anymore
uh-huh.
much. But would that include, like, instrumental music? It seems like that would be neutral. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Well,
I know the lyrics nowadays
well, you should,
are horrible.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you should never trust a kidder. The truth is that music is a gift of God. And so... music is a gift of God. It has been co-opted by the devil to promote his ways. It's true. Some people say, well, instrumental music was invented by evil people, the sons of Cain in Genesis chapter 4. Well, we're not told that the sons of Cain were evil people. Just because they're descended, you know, seven generations away from Cain doesn't mean that they're like Cain. We're not told those are bad people. We're just told that they invented instrumental music. But we also have David, who also invented instruments of music and used the ones that were available to glorify God. Now, Miss Kidder said that you know, any music that isn't for the glory of God is from Satan. I would say that's too sweeping. Certainly, Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, I think it's verse 30 or 31, he says, whatever you do, whether you eat or drink, do all to the glory of God, which means that really the ideal is that everything we eat, drink, say, do, should be as much as possible done to the glory of God. And therefore, we shouldn't do really anything that we don't feel in some sense is conducive to or consistent with the glory of God. That doesn't mean we have to do religious things all the time, because God's not just glorified in religious things. He's glorified in what we eat and drink, even, you know, it can be at least. And so my understanding would be there is such a thing as music that glorifies God. Some of it is actually written for that purpose. Bach, for example, Johann Sebastian Bach wrote his music specifically to glorify God, as did many of the other classical composers, though some of them were secular men who didn't write for that purpose, but their music's great too. Same thing is true of, you know, all kinds of popular music. Some of it's just pretty. Some of it's instrumental. Some of it's about love. Is love a bad thing? You know, what's Jesus got to do with love, right? You know, love is good. And now, of course, some of the music is about sin. Some of it's about hatred. Some of it's about violence. Some of it's about, you know, lust and fornication and drugs. Obviously, that kind of music, it's hard to imagine how that would really glorify God. Although I will tell you this, I lived a pretty pristine life growing up, and many years ago, I used to listen, and I still would. I'm not against it now, but I just don't do it much anymore. I used to listen a lot to Jackson Browne. Now, Jackson Browne would write about how empty life is, and he was using cocaine, and he'd sing about cocaine, and he'd sing about his, you know, sex life sometimes and so forth. And I think, you know, I wouldn't listen to that if it would induce me to want to think about using cocaine or live immorally. But what it did to me was the opposite. One of the most common words I found in his songs was emptiness, describing himself in his own life. I had never known that emptiness. I've been a Christian since I was a child. I've never felt empty ever. And it really was edifying to me to hear, so this is how it is for those people who pursue drugs, sex, and rock and roll. It's empty. You know, I mean, to me, that's an edifying thought, like reading Ecclesiastes, you know, where Solomon says, I did all this carnal stuff, and it was emptiness. Now, another person listening to the same music might not get that same, you know, message from it, especially someone who is attracted to cocaine or fornication. So it's going to be different for different people. I knew a woman who couldn't stay in a supermarket if the music that was playing over the speakers was from, you know, pop music from the 70s. And that's because she was using a lot of drugs in the 70s, and that was the music that brought it all back to her. She didn't want to be around it. She'd leave it. For me, the 70s were a time of Christian revival. It was a Jesus movement. And the pop music of that time, you know, I always experienced it through the grid of the revival, so that when I hear old pop music from the 70s, it takes me back to those days of the revival. Not that the music was about the revival. There was a lot of that, too. What I'm saying is, just because something isn't about God doesn't mean it can't be for the glory of God, at least for the particular listener. But indeed, if there is music that you in no sense can find glorifying to God, then I would suggest that you don't waste your time with it. It doesn't mean, though, that music that doesn't have the name God or Jesus in it, in other words, secular music, is from the devil. Because something like love, something like happiness, those can be, you know, those can be exploited by the devil or by God. And frankly, I don't think we should be legalistic about music, but we should be very cautious, knowing that music does shape our moods and sometimes our opinions, because the music does carry a message in many cases. But lots of music doesn't carry a very, you know, a dangerous message, just an expression of human love and things that are quite consistent with being a Christian. Anyway, those would be my thoughts on that. I appreciate you asking. Let's try to get one more call in here from Linda in Connecticut. Linda, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I just have a quick question about Mordecai and Haman. Why would not Mordecai bow down to Haman, who was a public official, and Joseph's brothers, when they came to Egypt, they bowed down out of respect for what they thought was the somebody, the Pharaoh's right-hand man.
Yeah. Well, sometimes in different cultures, bowing down to officials means nothing else than to show respect. Just like if you're speaking to a judge in court and called him your honor, you know, you're showing respect. It's simply a cultural way of being respectful to someone in a high office. In other cases, especially in the pagan world, bowing down to a king or to an official might, especially to a Jewish person, have the connotations of worshiping the wrong god or the wrong object. Now, when Peter walked into the house of Cornelius, Cornelius bowed down to him, and Peter said, "Get up, don't bow down to me, I'm just a man," you know. Yet, you know, there would possibly be times when Peter, in some circumstances where it was not anything other than just a cultural form of respect, might allow bowing down. Certainly, you know, not all bowing down is an act of worship. Some of it depends on the cultural setting. Apparently, Mordecai felt that to bow down to Haman would be to confer greater respect, or maybe a different kind of respect, than he, as a Jew, felt would be appropriate. You know, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would not bow down to the statue that Nebuchadnezzar commanded them to bow down to. But of course, we can say, well, that's directly in violation of the command, "You shall not, you know, have any other gods before me." But it may be possible that Mordecai, knowing Haman's character and mindset, just felt like, well, this guy wants me to bow down to him like a god, and I'm not going to do that, you know. Certainly, I think every Christian has the right to follow their conscience on this matter. If you, you know, if it became customary to bow down to a king or queen, if we lived in such a city or such a country, many people might do it without the slightest sense of worshiping, but just not seeking to be disrespectful. But other times, I mean, someone's conscience may tell them, well, this is, I don't bow to anyone but God. Mordecai was apparently of that opinion. Now, when Joseph's brothers bowed down to him, I think it was simply a matter of obeisance to a powerful ruler, not worship. Just trying to get hit, they're seeking a favor from him, so they're trying not to offend him, and they do what everyone else does. They bow down to him. But Joseph was not a ruler who was requiring people to worship him as a god, and therefore it was strictly a cultural way of showing respect to a powerful person whom you were hoping not to offend. So that'd be where I would see differences there. All right? I don't know of any other way to answer that. All right?
So, okay, thank you.
All right, God bless you. I have a quick question someone wrote in here. It says, "Steve, for thousands of years, Christians have gathered together for corporate worship, especially on Sundays. I'm not saying that Sunday is the only day to do this, but it has been this way for a long time. Is there more to say about this day in the Scriptures?" The answer is no. I mean, the first day of the week, which is Sunday, is mentioned in Scripture, but not mentioned as a necessary time to gather for public worship. We do know that the early church did so in the days of the church fathers, because they mention it, but it's not anything the Bible commands. Paul said, "One man esteems one day above another. Another man esteems every day alike." And therefore, you know, you can worship on Sunday if you want to, or you can worship every day. That would be my preference. I don't think Sunday is any different than any other day. Jesus is the Lord of every day, including Sunday. And so worshiping him on any given day is appropriate. We're out of time. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. If you'd like to help us, you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Our website's thenarrowpath.com. Have a good weekend. Talk to you Monday.